interview with Shlomo Hillel on August 14th, 2006. Let me start by asking you this question. Can you first tell me when you were born?
I was born in 1923 in Baghdad.
Uh-huh.
We're a family of 11 children, and I'm the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
We were 7 brothers and 4 sisters,
mm-hmm.
and I was the youngest, and I was always treated by all the family as the youngest member of the, even today I am 83.
Right.
When I meet my sisters, they treat me as if I was the kid.
The baby.
Yeah, you don't look well, you have to eat better, you have to do this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Are your siblings all alive today? Are your siblings alive today? All of them? Are all of them living?
All my brothers passed away.
Uh-huh.
I have still 2 sisters. 1 sister passed away.
Uh-huh.
So right now, I have still 3 sisters alive in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And I'm the only brother that was left, the youngest. That's right.
Okay. What neighborhood in Baghdad did you grow up in?
I can only remember the second neighborhood. I mean, I was born, I don't know exactly where,
okay.
but when I was about 2 years, we moved to Bab el-Agha, which is on the main road, on the main road of Baghdad, which was Shara al-Rashid.
Uh-huh.
That was at that time, there was only one, actually one road in, and we were living in a small, it was a Jewish quarter.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very close to the main road. As a matter of fact, our house had the windows to the main road.
Yeah.
From the windows we could see the main road. The main road. It was called Bab el-Agha.
Bab el-Agha,
which Agha is in Persian, which is Adon, sir.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gate of the. So I don't know who must have lived there, but the whole quarter was mainly populated by Jewish people.
Right.
No, not all of them, but almost more mm-hmm. and most of them. And it was a big house, like all the Iraqi houses. The court was inside, and the rooms
around it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, when I was, as I told you, I was the youngest. When I was born already, my brother started to go abroad, the old brothers. They went to India, to Bombay, like all good Jewish families that,
mm-hmm.
From Iraq, went to the east and to the far east. My brothers, almost all of them, started by going to Bombay, to India.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a commercial relationship with my father, who was in Baghdad. And
what did they do? What work did they do?
They used to import to Baghdad from India, cloth and tea.
I see.
We had a kind of a half monopoly of tea of Ceylon, which is now Ceylon is
very popular tea.
Yeah, no, it's not only that, but Ceylon now is called differently. That's a small island near India, how they call it.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. It was
Sri Lanka?
Pardon?
Sri Lanka?
Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
It could be, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because they changed the name. Pardon?
Right. So there was a big Hillel family in Bombay, in India in general. I interviewed a woman in New York named Yvonne Hillel Cohen. She married a man named Cohen, Barry Cohen, but she grew up in Calcutta. And I think her father's name was Abraham Hillel. I don't know.
As a matter of fact, there was quite a big Hillel family. There were second cousins and all that. Even now in Jerusalem, there is a very important rabbi by the name of Hillel, who was born in Bombay, was born in India, and he became a rabbi, and he is now head of one of the yeshivot in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. He was from an Iraqi family?
Yeah, sure. All Hillels are Iraqi family, but there is also a Hillel in Yemen, which we assume that one of the Hillels wandered one day from Iraq to Yemen, and there is also a Hillel family in India, but it's a very... Hillel is a real family, that's...
And it's a real Iraqi family.
Yeah, real Iraqi family. But one of them must have gone to Yemen, and there is also a Hillel family in Yemen as well. As I told you, my brother started by going to Bombay. Then later on, one of them went to England, to Manchester. Also, the center was always in Baghdad. My father was there, and they would send...
Import, export, clothes.
Mainly import. There was no export at that time. Mainly import to Baghdad, I mean. And then one of them went later on to Japan. So the family was dispersed. As a matter of fact, only my bigger brother, Eliyahu, which was very active, very Zionist, and he came to Palestine in 1932, I assume.
He was active in Achi Ever,
That's right.
Okay.
He was one of those who created the Achi Ever movement in Baghdad. And he was very involved in learning Hebrew and etc. And he came to Palestine and he went to Mikveh Yisrael, which is agricultural school, because he wanted to be a farmer. All of the others went to India and later on went to Japan or to England, etc. And when I was young, my parents used to visit my brothers in Bombay every second year. So I went with them four times to Bombay because I was the youngest. And
how was that? How was it visiting Bombay?
I can remember. I mean, the first time, probably not really. Probably I must have been 3 years old. But the last time, I must have been about 9 years old. So I do remember very well. At that time, my brother married in India, a woman that was born from an Iraqi family, but she was already born in India. To go from Baghdad to India at that time, it was a big story, because you have to go by train from Baghdad to Basra, which was about 24 hours in the train. And then you take the ship, which was 8 days from Basra to Bombay. It was a very big story, you know, not like that in a few hours that you finish. That's the story of my beginning.
Now, what is Achi Ever? Can you tell me a little bit about Achi Ever?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in 1917, by the end of the First World War, the British captured Iraq.
Right.
So, at that time in 1917, that was also the Balfour Declaration. So they brought with them the knowledge to the Jewish community in Iraq, which was under the Ottoman rule or for 400 years and all that. The story that there was the Balfour Declaration and there was the Zionist movement, etc. And Iraq was not yet independent. Iraq became independent only in 1932. So when Iraq was captured from the Ottoman Empire, it was under the British rule, even though they nominated Faisal as the king of Iraq, but it was a kingdom but under the domination of the British Empire. So Zionist activity was semi-legal. It was not illegal, it was semi-legal. And mainly Faisal the First was the king of Iraq. He was fairly friendly with the Jewish community. He was helped by the Jewish community, by the way. And he remained to be friendly with the Jewish community. So, at that time, teachers from Palestine came to teach in the Jewish schools in Iraq. The Jewish schools in Iraq were very highly developed in the high standard. And they came to teach Hebrew, and so it was legal to teach Hebrew, and so people from Palestine, Jews from Palestine, came to teach in the Jewish schools in Iraq. So with them they came with the Zionist idea, and the Achi Ever was a movement of youngsters who were in the high school, who decided that they want to learn Hebrew. They got newspapers from Palestine, which was possible at that time, and Hebrew books, etc. And they would meet a few times a week and speak amongst them only in Hebrew and all that. And I used to follow my brother as younger.
He was an inspiration to you.
Yeah.
Was he an inspiration to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the time that I came to Palestine, I came first time in 1933, and then in 1934, mm-hmm. I already could speak some Hebrew, not very well, mm-hmm. but I could cite some poems of Bialik and all that. So my brother was one of those who founded this Achi Ever movement,
right.
with some others. Now, the drastical change in Iraq took place, first of all, in 1932,
mm-hmm.
when Iraq got its independence the first time.
Right.
Iraq has never existed as a political entity, never.
Mm-hmm.
It was only the British who created Iraq, which was created by, like in a colonial way.
Yeah, lands like that.
Yes, and they had the Kurds and the Shiites and the Sunni, and now we know how complicated it was. But only 1932 Iraq became independent. But till 1933 there was not a drastic change, because Faisal I was still the king, and he passed away in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told you, he was very friendly with the Jewish community in Iraq. In 1933, his son, Ghazi,
mm-hmm.
Came to power. He was a hot-headed Arab, etc.
Nationalist.
Yeah. And at the same time, in Europe, in 1933, I'm speaking, the Nazi came to power.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to make a very important activity in some of the Arab or in the Middle East countries.
Mm-hmm.
So there was much influence of the Nazi and the Nazi
right.
Regime in Iraq. They had a very active ambassador, etc. So there was the combination of a king that was a hot-headed Arab nationalist, and the Nazi influence on top of that. So the teachers from Palestine were sent back home. And it was not allowed anymore to learn Hebrew, modern Hebrew, etc. At that time, my brother, Eliyahu, decided that he was living in, he left Iraq, and he came to Palestine, and he went to Mikveh Israel to learn agriculture in order to be a farmer in Palestine. And that was the time that the real change took place in Iraq. So by that time, all my sisters were still in Iraq. All my brothers, with the exception of Eliyahu and myself, were already abroad,
yeah.
Either in India or in England or in Japan, or, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of places. And in 1933, we came for a visit to Palestine because my sister was sick, and we came here to Jerusalem.
Mm.
She had to be treated, something. And I came again with my
yeah.
parents. And in 1934, already Eliyahu was here, but already two brothers of mine who were before that in India, and one of them was in Manchester, came to Palestine with their British passport,
mm-hmm.
so they could work with the British government as employees. And
good.
So I had already three brothers here. So I came with my father to visit them in 1934, and in summertime. But then I insisted that I don't want to go back to Iraq, because at that time it was clear to all of us that we should be moving to Palestine.
Yes. Uh-huh.
because it was clear that Iraq has changed entirely by the fact that it became, for the first time, under Muslim and Arab rule, because till that time, as I told you, Iraq has never been an independent country. It was under the Turkish Empire, or the Persian Empire, or the British Empire, but only at that time it became to be under the Arab or Muslim rule, and the very nationalistic with the Nazi influence on top of that. So I still remember that one of the first things that the King Ghazi did was the massacre of the Assyrian
Christians,
uh-huh. Yeah, community. Uh-huh. It was a real massacre at that time, probably 450 people killed, etc.
40 or 50? Is that what you said?
In 1933, I'm sorry.
Okay, and how many were killed?
About 500 or something.
Oh, wow.
Which was not terribly, but at that time it was a lot. And I still remember the parade of the Iraqi army in the main road of Baghdad, the victory that they won.
Wow.
And I remember my father saying, "Look, if this is what they do to Christians, what's going to happen to us?" But by that time, already my brother was in Palestine, and it was clear to all of us that we should be moving at a certain time to Palestine. So in 1934, when I came with my father to visit my brothers here, and he wanted to return back, I said, "I don't want to return back." I was 11 years old, and I insisted that I wanted to stay here and to go to Jewish school in Tel Aviv. And he agreed to leave me with my two brothers. Eliyahu was in Mikve Israel, but my two brothers, they had a very one room rented I still remember a milkman rented a room to my two, and I stayed with them. At the age of 11, they would come only by 11 at night. They would find me sleeping on the bed with my clothes on, etc.
So you basically took care of yourself because they were at work during the day.
Absolutely, they went to work, and then they went to play bridge and all that. They never came before 11 o'clock at night. And but it was all right with me. And I went to the Herzliya Gymnasium School, which was the highest prestigious school in those days. And only about a year later, my family, which means my parents, and my sister, who was one and a half years older than me, because the other sisters were already married. One of them was already in Palestine. The two other sisters were married and were staying in Baghdad. So the family came in 1935 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time on, we were all together. Then gradually, my sisters came with their family much later,
later
1940,
right.
etc. The other brothers, four of them as a matter of fact, because Menashe was in Palestine, were one in Tokyo, one in Bombay, and one in the United States, in New York, etc., dispersed all over.
Right. Now, one of the things that you write in the beginning of your book is about how you initially became involved in bringing the Jews of Iraq to Israel, which was that your wife, then girlfriend, Tamima, came up with the Patria.
Yes.
And that was an inspiration to you.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that when you first started thinking about bringing the Jews of Iraq?
Well, not really. I mean, first of all, I think I mentioned in my book that there have been few. Look, when the war started, because we are already speaking about 1939, the war started. We gradually came to know what's happening to the Jews in Europe, not immediately, but and there was the illegal immigration of the Jews from Europe, even in 39, I still remember, I think it was the Tiger Hill that arrived in 1939. I think it was on the outbreak of the Second World War. And it arrived to the shores of Tel Aviv, and there they managed to... I mean, this was the inspiration of Jews who wanted to run away from Europe, which was at war,
right.
and the Germans already... And the Kristallnacht in Germany, and Jews persecuted, etc. So this was one thing which I remember. And then, during the war, we by the way, in 1941, there was something which was very important. In Iraq, there was the Farahud, which was the pogrom that took place in Iraq,
right.
Because Iraq started to collaborate with the Germans, and there was a pro-German government in Iraq. The pro-British government had to run away. The government was taken by the pro-Nazi
Rashid Ali,
that's right. And there was a pogrom in I think it was the 1st and 2nd of June or July.
Right, June 1941.
And there was some massacre in about 180 Jews who were killed in Baghdad, and a few hundreds wounded,
mm-hmm.
and synagogues, and the pogroms all over. So this we have already known, because people started to come illegally to Palestine.
Right.
How come? Because with the British army that had to invade Iraq again, British army who gave Iraq their independence in 1932,
mm-hmm.
They had to recapture Iraq, because they didn't want the Iraqis to collaborate with the Nazi and the oil to go to the Nazis, etc.
Right.
So they entered, they captured Iraq again in 1931.
Uh-huh.
And 1941. I'm sorry. And with the British army, there have been already some Jewish Palestinian soldiers who were there, and also auxiliary forces, because they wanted to build airports, etc. So many Jews from Palestine, either by uniform of the army or by auxiliary forces, went with the British to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
So starting in 1941-42, there have been quite a number of Jews from Palestine who were in Baghdad, either because they were doing the works for the British army or soldiers, etc. And the Jewish community there, that they had the traumatic experience of the pogrom,
mm-hmm.
that happened in 1941. And all of a sudden they see that in the streets of Baghdad there are a lot of Jews from Palestine going openly, because it was with the British army. And they started to smuggle some of them to bring them to Palestine. The youngsters wanted to run away,
mm-hmm.
from Iraq. So at that time there is already some Jews who came, mainly youngsters, who came from Iraq to Palestine.
With the help of the Jewish-British soldiers.
That's right, that's right. And then later on through Syria, because Syria and Lebanon were also taken by the British and the Free French at that time.
Right.
So there was a quite relatively important, a few hundreds a year, illegal immigration of Jews from Iraq, either through the British... the Jewish British Army,
uh-huh.
or from Syria and Lebanon, from Lebanon to Palestine, it was relatively easy.
Like with truck drivers, I remember you describing truck drivers going over to Jordan.
Now to go from Baghdad to Damascus, it was still possible, and from Damascus to Beirut, and then by all kind of drivers to come to Palestine. So there was a kind of illegal movement of Jews who came from Iraq.
Did they go through Jordan at all? Or only through Syria?
No. If they came with the army, they crossed Transjordan.
Right.
They crossed Jordan, or at that time it was still Transjordan.
Right.
It became Jordan only in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Because the British army and our soldiers were with the British army or the auxiliary forces. they passed through Transjordan directly to Iraq. But those who supposedly went for vacation to Damascus, etc., that was a different
That was independent.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So, and then there was, I was at that time a member of a kibbutz, mm-hmm. one of the founders.
Which kibbutz?
Which is now Ma'agan Michael.
Ah, okay.
Which is on the seashore, which is one of the nicest kibbutz in the country, that's right.
I agree.
Yeah, you agree.
I agree.
Okay. So I was one of the founders, as a matter of fact. And the founders of the kibbutz were either the graduates of the Gymnasia Herzliya, the Herzliya Gymnasium in Tel Aviv, which was the high rank in Tel Aviv, or in Haifa the Reali, which is also very high. People from the scout movement we were at the time, but we received two groups of Europeans, youngsters, who came before the war without their families, which we called the youth Aliyat Noir.
Ah, okay. The youth
Aliyah, that's right. That was Henrietta Sol, who organized to get boys and girls without their families to bring them to Palestine,
right.
Few hundreds of them. So we received two groups. One of them was my wife, was
yeah.
one of them, that's right. Uh-huh. But she came later on, she came with a ship that was passed on to Patria, that was thrown in the port of Haifa. I think mm-hmm. the story is written in the book, so I'm not going to go into details. So in 1945, our kibbutz, who were at that time in Pardes Hana,
mm-hmm.
we were ordered to move from Pardes Hana to Rehovot. And that was the responsible of the kibbutz at that time, in order to build in the underground a factory for the production of bullets in 1945. That was the end of the Second World War.
Right.
And it became more or less clear that there is a possibility that a Jewish state will be created.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was that till that time, all our wars or skirmishes with the Arabs were with the Palestinians who were there. So 100 Palestinians attacked a remote kibbutz and they shot here and they shot there and 10 people were killed. But it was only with the local
Palestinians, right.
Yes, there have been people who came from Iraq to help them, but it was clear that if a Jewish state was going to be proclaimed, then we will have to fight the Arab the armies of the neighboring Arab countries,
right.
Organized armies with tanks, with the airplanes, real armies, mm-hmm. from Egypt, who had its own army, from Jordan, who had already its army, from Syria, etc. So it was clear that we must have not just the Haganah, but a real Israeli army as well. And one of the things that was badly needed was bullets for the stain gun that was at the use of the Haganah in those days.
So you were producing these bullets for the Haganah?
Yeah. Okay. So we were ordered to leave Pardes Hana, to go to near Rehovot, to build a factory 8 meters underneath the surface. I think it's worthwhile that you go and see it.
Uh-huh.
And in order to build a factory for the production of the bullets, which was the main thing that was needed for the Haganah in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already in Rehovot in those days, dealing with the Haganah all the time.
Yeah. And so Ma'agan Michael initially went from Pardes Hana to Rehovot, and then
It was not yet called Ma'agan Michael, it was called the Pusat HaTzofim Aleph. The first group of the scout movement.
Right.
That was so because we were hoping that we are going to establish a new kibbutz. So we were waiting in Pardes Hana in order to receive the funds and to get the land.
Mm-hmm.
In between, we were ordered by the Haganah, forget what you have in mind. Now you are going to build a factory underneath the surface and to produce bullets. And you have to forget your dreams till the time comes.
Right.
So we left Paz Hana. We built this factory in Rehovot, which is now a museum that is worthwhile visiting. Mm-hmm. And I was responsible for the kibbutz. I was all the time in contact with the Haganah, etc. And I'm speaking now in 1945. By the end of 1945, the major thing that we were dealing with, it was already after the war,
mm-hmm.
was the illegal immigration.
Right.
I mean, the people from Europe who had nowhere to return after the Holocaust, or did not return to return to the places that all their families have been exterminated, and they wanted to come to Palestine, they were intercepted by the British. That was the main and the most important thing that we thought we had in mind. That we were dealing with the illegal immigration, and on top of that, as I told you, I remember the Tiger Hill, and I remember the Patria, and the ship that was drawn in,
So that was the main obsession at that time was.
The main thing that you said, I want to make the most important thing, even though we were dealing with the factory of bullets, which was very important.
Right.
When we finished building the factory, I thought, now what I'm going to do, I want to do something else.
Right.
So I suggested to my friends with the Haganah, with whom I've been working every day, I want to do something more important to deal with illegal immigration. They said, all right, if you want. Probably at that time I had in mind that I would be sent to Paris or to Rome, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
So they came to me and they said, something happened in Iraq because, as I told you, there was all the time some illegal immigration
right.
with the British Army or the auxiliary forces that were there.
Right.
But the war ended, the British Army left Iraq. Iraq got its independence entirely again, the British Army left,
mm-hmm.
so there was no way for the continuation of this kind of illegal immigration. Illegal,
yeah.
But it was semi-legal.
Semi-legal,
yeah,
because
yeah.
the British were helping.
So the underground activity in Iraq became really much more difficult.
I see.
And they said, you fit very well in Iraq, you were born in Iraq, you have Iraqi face, you can speak some Arabic, not very well, but
mm-hmm.
good enough for everyday's life. And I was sent to Baghdad in 1946.
Okay.
At first I was sent in order to organize the Zionist underground movement to teach them Hebrew, to tell them how to organize them, etc. Gradually I was involved in dealing with the illegal immigration in 1946 and 47. I stayed at that time for 1 year. And it was very difficult because the easiness of during the war ended,
right.
and we had to look for trucks that would put underneath some three or four young boys and girls and to bring them through the desert. It was
right.
sounds easy, but it's very difficult in summertime.
Smuggler,
it was horrible.
Truck.
Yeah, exactly. In the trucks, etc. Because at that time, Iraq had its port for Europe in Haifa.
Mm-hmm.
So they would send dates, say, to Haifa.
Ah.
Because at that time, the main port for Iraq to Europe was from Haifa.
Wow.
So there have been a lot of activity of trucks going from Baghdad to Haifa
mm-hmm.
to bring
all sorts of material.
Yeah, material.
But mostly dates. Was that the main export?
At that time, yes. At that time,
yeah.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was relatively easy, but nevertheless it was. And we had some tragedy. People were killed on the way.
Right.
And after a year, I returned to Palestine, exhausted after 1 year in the underground. You can imagine
right.
it was not easy. And that's where the idea of the Meitelberg came.
Okay.
Because it was already in 1947, and again, the main thing that was in everybody's mind was the illegal immigration. At that time, if I'm not mistaken, it was already the story of the exodus that was here, that was intercepted
right.
by the British, and then later on it was sent back to Europe, the story of the exodus, which probably you know about.
Right, sure, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that we had some American pilots
mm-hmm.
that they were pilots in the war. I mean,
in World War II,
they were expert
okay.
Pilots, and the war finished, and they didn't want to return to be clerks or I don't know what.
Right.
So they decided to continue to do what they learned in the army to fly planes and to smuggle. They would smuggle anything, gold, hashish, whatever, who were paid.
As long as they were paid well.
Well, they were paid well. And
yeah.
someone in the United States told them, look, here in Palestine, there are some crazy people who are ready to pay a lot of money for smuggling people. They said, we don't care,
really?
as long as they...
And they were not Jewish pilots?
No, right. Absolutely. No. American pilots from the war. And at that time, when I returned back and I was angry that we are not doing enough, etc., these two pilots came to Haifa.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was all the time claiming that we are not doing enough and I'm angry and I was shouting and I was complaining and cursing and all that, they said, oh, there is Shlomo here all the time complaining. And that's how it happened that I was given the possibility to bring the first illegal immigration by planes from the most dangerous place.
Right.
Because it would have been much easier to do it from Italy, from anywhere. Because at that time, in Europe...
You mean to Italy?
Pardon?
You mean to it, from Baghdad to Italy?
No. From Europe...
Yeah.
The Jews wanted to come from Europe to Palestine,
right?
Because the ships were intercepted by the British Navy,
right?
And there have been a lot of youngsters in Europe, in Italy, in France, in Switzerland, who were waiting to be taken to Palestine,
mm-hmm.
and many youngsters, as a matter of fact, were waiting there, and in Europe, the illegality of immigration at that time was only to enter Palestine, because neither France nor Italy nor Switzerland cared for the Jews to run away from, to go
right.
from Italy. Even from their point of view, they wanted to get rid of the Jews.
Right.
They didn't want those who survived from the Nazi death camps to remain in these places.
Right.
So, I mean, the Italian government and the French government and the Italian population, they did not intervene, they did not stop the Jews from running away from Italy. The problem of illegal immigration was only entering Palestine.
Right.
While when we are speaking about Iraq, the illegality started from being there at all,
right.
from organizing a Jewish activity, from leaving Iraq and from crossing either Jordan at the time or Syria and Lebanon. So, I mean, the illegality from the Arab countries was much different after the Second World War, when we are speaking about 1946-47,
mm-hmm.
than when we are speaking about the illegality from Europe.
Right.
Because the illegality from Europe was only the entering of Palestine.
Right.
And here,
and
from the beginning,
all the way
you have to pass through Jordan, through Syria, etc.,
right.
and to enter Palestine. So this was the most dangerous place to start with. But I assume because I was there and I was complaining and I was shouting, and there comes two pilots with the plane in Haifa, someone said, look here, let's try to satisfy this guy and ask him, all right, you are complaining, can you organize full
right.
plane of... And that's why I came to me, and that's why it happened that I was the first one to bring the illegal immigration by plane.
Right. Now, the Jews at that time, let's say that was 1946?
47.
1947. So the Jews at that time in Iraq, did they have passports? Could they actually
no,
leave Iraq?
No, they could not leave Iraq at all.
Okay.
and no question to go to Palestine.
Right.
But even those who had, I don't know, with a special case to go to Europe, they have to leave part of their family and to leave money, etc.
Right.
They were not allowed to leave at all. No,
right.
No, there was no question of going anywhere else.
Right.
No question of going anywhere. So I was given the chance, because it so happened,
uh-huh.
that instead of doing the first illegal immigration by planes from Europe, which was done the second time, by the way, which was a very, very funny story which I'll tell you about, we did it from the most dangerous place to go to Iraq and to organize, just because I was there and I was complaining and shouting all the time, they wanted to shoot me out.
You do it.
Yeah. So go ahead and do it. And it was successfully done. I'm not going to repeat if you have it in the book.
Right.
It might be bad.
But tell a little bit about it. Give me a short summary of what happened in Michaelburg.
No one had in mind how it's going to be done.
Uh-huh.
Not even the pilots.
Right.
So the main idea was that, all right, we are going to go to Baghdad, and they can take 50 passengers. There were no seats because it was cargo. Cargo.
Empty, nothing
at all. It was cargo plane. So we'll go to Baghdad, and then they said that they will land somewhere, at a certain time when we are ready with my 50 passengers. They will go and land somewhere in the desert, and I will have to bring the people to the desert, to that place, and then we were supposed to arrive very early in the morning to Palestine. Early enough that the British were still sleeping,
right.
But there would be enough light to see where we are going to land, because
we
could not land in an ordinary airport. So we were supposed to land in Yavniel, which is a small village near on top of the Tiberiad, on top of the Lake of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And so there should be enough light to see where is this small village there.
Right.
So we had to leave after midnight.
Wow.
You take into account about three and a half, four hours flight.
Uh-huh.
So, and that was the idea.
Where did you leave from? Did you leave from a patch of desert in Iraq, or did you leave from...
When I left Palestine with these two pilots, the idea was that we should find a place in the desert and I would bring the 50 passengers.
Right.
And it was done so quickly, I didn't have the time even to think about it.
Right.
Because I left the kibbutz in the morning and I thought I would go back because, yes, it was... I thought we were discussing the possibility about immigration by planes, but it didn't occur to me that I have to rush from Tel Aviv to Haifa, and the planes were already there, and
right.
let's go.
I remember in the book you described your flight, your first flight that you had ever taken from, I guess it was from Haifa with the pilots to Baghdad, and you were looking down on the desert and trying to figure out where you were going to take off from this vast desert, right? Were you looking down, trying to choose a place to leave from?
First of all, we have to take off from Haifa.
Uh-huh.
From Haifa. At that time, it's funny to say it now. At that time, most of my colleagues in the Haganah dealing with illegal immigration, they have never flown in their life. They're not really in plane. I'm speaking about 1946-47.
Right.
And we were only speaking about ships. I happened to have flown twice in my lifetime.
Ah, you did, okay.
Because I went to Baghdad in 46 by plane and I came back again by plane.
Right.
So I was supposed to be a kind of expert.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked, do you think it's possible to do it?
Yeah.
Because I've already... And as a matter of fact, it turned to be that really my experience has proven to be very, very important.
Uh-huh.
Because when I went with these two pilots from the small airport in Haifa, it was already three times that I've been flying. And I learned something which was very, I mean, I was told.
You spoke for the first time when you went for that 1 year to Iraq.
That's right. Okay. And then when I returned back, I also came by plane. So
right.
It was the second time. And now we have taken off from Haifa the third time.
Right.
And we were supposed to say that we are going to land in Baghdad, that's all right, and I'll have to have 1 or 2 days to organize the 50 passengers and to bring them to a certain place on the desert, and the plane will land there. And this was the main idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was so quick, I only on the way on the plane I started to think, how on earth am I going to do it? I mean, to find a place in the desert, who can show exactly where the place is? And after midnight, to bring the people to that place, I started to be scared, but it was already too late to be scared.
Right.
Especially because we have had an experience of a meeting that was supposed to take place in the desert with I think it's also written in the book, mm-hmm. with 40 youngsters and there was a tragedy, they couldn't, and there was a storm in the desert, and two people were killed.
Yes.
I was scared.
So you were panicked a little bit.
And I thought, how on earth am I going to do it? But it was already too late to say, look here.
Right.
But already I learned something from my third flight already.
What was that?
That in every airport you go, even today, when you are in the main, then you are checked 10 times. If you have your ticket and you have your passport and you stand here,
right.
And the plane is checked and no one can enter the plane, then the plane is checked and it goes to the end of the runway,
right.
Which is about 1 mile
away, yeah.
In the midst of nowhere, and the plane goes there, and at that time it was propeller.
Planes, yeah.
Propeller planes that it has to take about 4 or 5 minutes to heat it up.
Right.
The plane goes to the midst to the end of the runway. There was nothing there.
Isn't there a fence around the edge of the runway?
There is a fence,
yeah.
All right. But there is no building, there is no police, there is no custom,
right.
There is nothing. You go there and the plane stands there for 5 minutes to warm the propeller.
Yeah.
And then it occurred to me, I mean, after the third time that I have seen this something, that if I will be able, and then on top of that, we landed in Baghdad
in the airport.
On the way, we started to look in different places, but already we landed in Baghdad. It was midsummer time in August,
right.
1947. We landed, I think, sometime probably at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. The heat, you can't imagine, probably 45 degrees in
wow.
in
much hotter than even in Israel?
Absolutely.
Wow.
You can't compare that.
Wow.
And so the airport was empty again.
Wow.
Till and then it came to me that if the plane will be checked, we are going to send a telegram to the plane that you have to come to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
This was prearranged, that's
okay.
All right. And the plane will be checked, it's empty, and it's going to go to the end of the runway,
mm-hmm.
after midnight. And if I will be able to get my 50 youngsters, my 50 boys and girls, waiting at the end of the runway, and at the time that he will heat up the engines and the propellers,
uh-huh.
and with the lights to blind everyone,
right.
so that now,
no,
if I will be able to have them there already by that time,
right.
and we can use the 4 or 5 minutes that I have at my disposal in order to put them into the plane, and everything will be settled.
Wow.
So I came to that idea. I was not supposed to do it. I was ordered, as a matter of fact, to take them from the desert. This was what the pilots had in mind. And when I came to tell them the first time, look here, I have the idea to take them from the international airport of Baghdad, they thought I am out of my mind, I am crazy, till I convinced them. But really, the whole story is written in the book.
Right.
But I'm telling you, I mean, at first I was joking that because they said that you have flown twice in your time, so you are an expert. Now it really turned to be very useful.
Yeah.
Because I learned that every plane after being checked, it goes to the end of the runway,
and then
it's empty, and then you have 4 or 5 minutes at your disposal that you can do with whatever you want.
Yeah.
So this is how it worked, as a matter of fact. And we arrived at in Baghdad, it was on Wednesday in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday at night, I had my 50 passengers waiting at the end of the runway.
How did you get them over the fence? They just climbed over? It's not
we
like
the visited the fence, I mean, already the first night. I'm not going to go into
right.
it because it's...
But you went over the fence.
The fence was not very well done, so we helped it to be a little less.
Yeah.
And then I had a group of people who knew how to take the people from the main road alongside the fence and the place in which the fence was opened
uh-huh.
in order to get them inside. This was the easy part
right.
of it. Okay. We were more or less experienced.
Uh-huh.
And that is how the first flight came.
Uh-huh.
Now, what I want to tell you is, again, a funny story. The plane from here, we landed, and there was a story about the money that the pilots believed that they were going to get the money there in beforehand, and our people thought...
Yes, I remember this.
This is the story, and then I had to sign a check on my personal
check. Your personal check,
yeah.
You made up that you had a bank account in the Chemical Bank of New York.
Exactly.
That's my bank.
$10,000, you can... I signed it, etc.
Right. Because
so,
he had been expecting the money before.
But my people believed that he was supposed to get the money on arrival because
right.
he altered in golden coins. But it was a whole story, and you can read it. It's not
true. It's a good story.
The second flight, and from here, the plane actually went to Italy,
mm-hmm.
where it was supposed to take another 50 people to bring them from Italy. And already the system that I developed was sent by telegram immediately to Italy. How to do it? You go to an airport at the end of there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was accepted. But why we did it in a way that no one knew about it?
Right.
And we did it all by our own people. Because, I mean, sometimes you would take a truck driver, a Muslim. We did it all by ourselves with the people from the underground.
Now, what did the Iraqi Airport Authority think was on that plane? They just
thought
there were two British soldiers.
He got the telegram that you have to come to Rome to take a cargo. So he went to say, look, I will send my to go back to play. I'm sorry. And I came here because I thought I'm going to bomb. And then
they
checked the plane, empty, nothing in the plane. And they said, all right, go to hell, go where you want. So I went to the end of the runway, and then the whole story was done. Now, in Italy, it was done. But in Italy, there was no real secrecy.
Right.
And it was done in a way that the next day in the Corriere della Sera, which is the most important paper in Italy,
uh-huh.
it was written, there is a funny story about a plane that came here and landed and taken 50 passengers to Palestine.
Right.
Because they did not work in the same underground feeling like we did in Baghdad,
right.
that no one knew about it whatsoever.
Wow.
Only our own people who were involved.
But did you go to Italy or did you go directly to Palestine? On that first flight, did you go directly to Palestine?
We came to Palestine, we landed the people in Yavneel, and the plane and the pilots got the suitcase with the 50 pounds,
uh-huh.
with the 5,000 pounds. In golden coins,
uh-huh.
and from here he went to Italy, and from Italy he came back. But the story came out in the Corriere della Sera, but it looked so funny that no one really believed it. So it was
everybody brushed it on.
Yeah, brushed it off. But in any case, that's how I came to be the man who brought the first airlift illegal immigration to
right.
Palestine in 1947. Mm. That was the story.
Then you did it again. You did Michael Berg again. You did another flight, didn't you?
No, the other flight was done already without me. But the system was there.
The system was there.
The system was there, and it was done exactly to the. Now to my mind, the most important thing was what came much later. It was already by we are speaking about August, September 1947. In November, by the end of November 1947, there was the resolution of the United Nations about the partition.
Right.
And and in between, there was another convoy that managed to come out from Baghdad. With a friend of mine, Sami,
yeah.
With about 70, those probably the biggest convoy.
70 passengers.
Yeah, probably 77, uh-huh. If I'm not mistaken, uh-huh. That really crossed the desert all the time, this time with the experience that there should be not one track, but few, in uh-huh. order that if one is broken. But so we had by the end of the year some fairly important numbers already, two planes with 100 passengers and 77 people by, and we thought that we were overcoming the difficulty.
Right.
So there came the resolution of the United Nations that made it impossible to cross the desert anymore gradually. Actually, the last time that we had a convoy that was sent was in February 1948, that was the end of it.
How many Michael Berg flights were there?
There were three flights.
Three.
And then we were stopped by the commanders of the Haganah.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because
it was already, I'm speaking about September 1947.
Right.
It was clear that we are going to have a kind of a state and we are going to be in a war.
Uh-huh.
And they came to the conclusion that it's going to be the best way to smuggle not small arms like pistols or guns that you can put it in a suitcase, but big guns or tanks, etc.
Uh-huh.
So they decided that it's much more important for the time being to use this system of the Michael Berg to bring heavy ammunition and not passengers.
Uh-huh.
And they ordered us, even though we were part of the Haganah, not to use it anymore more for bringing immigrants, because this would risk it to be, especially after the story of the Corriere della Sera.
Right.
So they have taken this flight system and used it in order to smuggle arms.
Where did they smuggle the arms from?
From Czechoslovakia, from Italy, from
so those pilots went off with their planes.
Another pilot.
But
the system was already accepted, and in every airport you have the runway, you have the end of the runway, and from that point it was easy. In 1948 we managed to smuggle small numbers of people from planes, civil planes who went from Baghdad to Cairo,
mm-hmm.
and had to stop over in Lida, in which is now Ben Gurion Airport.
Right.
And with a forged passport, every time we smuggled one or two couples, and I used to wait for them in the Lida airport and smuggle them from the Lida airport, because it was very complicated, to Tel Aviv.
Right.
But even the airport fell in the hands of the Arabs in April 1947, and that was absolutely the end. There was no way anymore to bring people out of Iraq, not even one single couple that we used from time to time. So the war started in the 15th of May 1948,
mm-hmm.
and we started to receive the telegrams, because we had the underground system of
the wireless
system,
right.
That the situation is horrible, and people are arrested and harassed, and etc. Please come and help us. And again I was asked, look here, you have to go back to Baghdad. And I said, but look, there's no way out.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I was told, and I still remember that, let's not be in a situation that people will say that when they were in such a tragedy, we never answered their call. Because all of us, we had the conscience of the Second World War, when the Jews in Europe felt that we did not do enough.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there is nothing to do, let them have the feeling they called for us and we said,
I see. Wow. Probably it was even symbolic. The second time you went back, it was in a way symbolic. Or just not a third time.
Yeah, but, yeah. But from all points of view, I was supposed to be the one who was going and to remain there without doing anything.
Yeah.
Only, again, it so happens. I'm telling you, because whatever I did, I never contemplated this. It so happened that. So to go to Baghdad.
You never contemplated the big picture.
No.
You just kept going with the.
Yeah, and all of a sudden something popped in and I used it in order to. So in order to go to Baghdad this time, I could not take the plane because it was already the war. It was June 1948. The war was raging. And by the end of the first truce that was there, by the end of June, I think, I was told, you go to Paris and from there you can get a plane that will take you to Baghdad.
Right.
And they gave me a false passport that was very bad.
Yeah.
Again, it was a long story. And I got to Paris, and I was stuck there because they found that the passport is not good enough to go with it in Baghdad.
Right.
And our people of the Haganah and the illegal and the Mossad of Aliyah, which was dealing
Mossad Aliyah Bet.
Yeah. At that time, we were dealing also by smuggling people and also arms,
right.
Combined together.
Mm-hmm.
They were working from morning from 24.
Morning to night.
Yeah. 24 hours a day, as a matter of fact, dealing. And no one had the time to deal with me, and I said, look here, so I gradually started to go to the office and try to help them, you know, to answer the telephones and all that, to our office in Paris.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I learned something, that in Europe, sometimes you move, I don't know, 3,000 people from Italy to France in order to get them on the ship.
Yeah.
And the next day you move 100 people from Switzerland to Norway.
Step by step.
I mean, moving from one place to the other.
Yeah.
So I started to come to the conclusion, if we cannot get the people, and we knew that there have been some people, who were very active, that the police were after them,
yeah.
And we wanted to smuggle them out. Our main people who were active, that the Iraqi police was trying to get. And I thought to myself, all right, if you can't get them westbound to Palestine,
right.
Probably you can get them to Turkey or to Iran,
right.
Muslim countries, but they were not at war with us.
Right.
And I went to my responsible people in the Mossad to tell them, look, here, I have the bright idea,
uh-huh.
That probably we should try something through Iran, also Turkey, and at that time, believe me, no one even knew that Iran is not an Arab country. For
right.
Us, it was all the
was
same,
all,
also,
Arab.
All Arabs also,
right.
And they did not know the history that there is animosity between Iraq and Iran,
mm-hmm.
for centuries, and they brushed me off, okay, all right, you wait till you get your passport and we're going to get rid of you. And so I was, at the time, And no one considered me seriously. Till I happened to meet the Abbe Glasberg, which is the priest.
Glasberg. Yeah.
Which I mean, if you have a Jewish ear, you know that Glasberg is a Jewish name.
Right.
But he was a priest. He was a Catholic priest.
Wasn't he? He was originally born to a Jewish family.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
So he was converted, etc. And I came to meet him in Palestine when I came back from Syria and Lebanon in December 1947. And all of a sudden, one day he entered our office in Paris, in the Lido, in the passage of the Lido in Paris, which is uh-huh. A very nice place, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, what are you doing here? And he has taken me to lunch because I treated him well when he was in Palestine and I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to squeeze out of me the whole story, first of all, where I was supposed to go. And,
uh-huh.
And then I even told him the story, look here, and I came to the idea that you can smuggle people to Iran, but I was brushed off. And he said, look here, I still remember that he, when we first met in Palestine, I started to speak to him in English, and he said, I don't speak English, let's speak French. My French at that time was fairly weak. I said, my French is not good enough. So he said, let's speak Yiddish. And I told him, look, I don't speak Yiddish. So he says to me, how on earth a Jewish boy in Palestine does not speak Yiddish? And I was on the point of asking him, how comes that Christian Catholic speak it? But I didn't ask him. At that time, I didn't know the story that he was a Jew converted.
Right.
But when I told him about this Iranian story, he said, okay, you told me that you don't speak Yiddish, but you have a Yiddish cop, Yiddish head,
right.
A Jewish head, mm-hmm. because this is an excellent idea, and I'm going to help you.
So at this point you were speaking to him in French?
Yes, I mean, it was bad French, with mistakes, etc., but right. we managed.
Yeah.
And so I did some mistakes, so what? And he said, I'm going to help you. How are you going to help me? He said, there is the Assyrian community in Iran, which has been persecuted sometimes in Iraq, sometimes in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I am helping them all the time. I have my friends there. I'm sending them money, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they have on the border between Iraq and Iran some monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they are... that they are getting people out of Iraq into Iran, smuggling people out of Iraq into Iran. So probably they can be helpful to you, and I'm going to come with you and I will introduce you to my friends there, mm-hmm. and they will help you. But the main thing that he did, he went to my superiors in the Mossad, Lali Abed, to mm-hmm. tell them, look here, I heard the idea of they used to call me Shammai, the idea of... And this is an excellent idea, and I want to go with him and help him. And since he was so respected by all of us, no one dared to tell him, look here, it's rubbish. He said, all right, you want to go to there? Okay, go for a week, and let's see what will happen.
Why was he so well respected?
Because he during the war, during the Second War, even though he became a Christian priest,
mm-hmm.
and he left his Jewish... he found himself dealing with something, rescuing Jewish boys during the Second World War from the Germans in order to rescue them and to put them in monasteries and to get them to Spain, etc. And he was looked for... The Germans wanted to get to arrest him.
Right.
And instead they arrested his brother and killed his brother because they thought it was him. So during the war, this guy who left, wanted to be a Christian, etc.,
right.
found himself dealing with by rescuing Jewish boys during the war.
Amazing.
Then after the war, he was connected by some of our people, by the way, by French people, to tell him, look here, right now, we want to... continue to rescue the Jews that you are trying to the war in the danger of your life. And he started to help the people in the illegal immigration.
Right.
And one of the things that he did for which he was so, that when the exodus was intercepted by the British, and the British decided to send it back to where it came from, to Marseille.
Right.
And he was the man who organized all the demonstrations in France to tell them, don't oblige them to come down to France.
Wow. Send them back to Palestine.
But the British would not take them back to Palestine because, so they have taken them to Hamburg, to Germany. And this was the uproar that the British were taking Jews who were rescued from the, and take them back to Germany.
Wow.
And this was, to my mind, one of the things that was the reason for the vote in the United Nations. That was one of the things that really...
In 1947.
Hit, yeah, in 1947.
Yeah.
That really brought people to say, look here, it's impossible.
Right.
What the British are doing, the British did the mistake that they wanted to give them back to France. The Abbé Glasberg with his friends demonstrated day and night and shouted, and the French government said, we are not going to oblige them.
Oh, yeah.
And the British were stuck there, So they came to the silly idea to take them to Hamburg, to Germany, and to land them back in Germany where they came from. This was an uproar.
So Glassberg inadvertently helped create that UN resolution, essentially.
To my mind, he has contributed a lot to that.
Right.
I mean, he was not the only one, but it was one of the contributors, because it was one or two votes that passed the resolution.
Right.
So everyone contributed something, and probably he contributed the one or two votes that was needed in order to pass those. So he was very, and that's why he was sent to Palestine after the thing, and there when I met him, and he was really very respected, because all the time he was helping our people in this illegal immigration and in everything.
Amazing. Is he still alive?
No, impossible. And so it was decided that I will go, and the week after that he will come with his secretary, because he would not go without her anywhere.
That's also, oh, really?
Funny story, she was half Jewish. He was really Jewish, and she was half Jewish. And they came to Tehran, and I met them there.
You had a French passport at that time, and you were Marcio Perez.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And actually, he has taken me to the Monseigneur in Tehran of the Syrian community, and together we drove to the border of Iraq and Iran, and to the monastery. And again, the whole story is written in the book. And
that story with the Assyrian Christians ended up being a disappointment. It didn't work out, right?
It didn't work out. No.
Right.
But what worked out is that, first of all, I went to Tehran with him. And then it was clear to me that it was possible to smuggle people out of Iraq into Iran, because this was what they were doing. And the most important thing is that, at the meantime, I started to have connection with some people Jewish people in Tehran. One of them was a Jew from Palestine, who was there, was capable like me, it's
right.
And we had connection with the police in Tehran, and they said that for the good money that they will receive, people who will get out of Iraq into Iran, they will not be sent back to Iraq, because this will be the end of their life.
Right.
But they will be brought to court, they will have to pay fine, and if we have visas for them, they will allow them to go somewhere else.
I see.
This was a very important achievement.
Right.
Now the question was, where can I get the visas from?
Right.
And this was the second contribution of the Abbey.
Of the Assyrians.
Of the Glassberg. No, the Syrians told me that it was possible, and I was convinced. And that was
why couldn't they help you?
They were so miserable themselves at the end.
Yeah.
I helped them, and I bought them a truck, and I gave them. It was they were much more miserable than the Jewish community there. So
right.
I could not depend upon them anymore.
But you learned from that experience that you could smuggle the Iraqi Jews over the border to Iran.
Exactly.
Okay.
But again, at that time, I was thinking probably 10, 20, 50 or something. But then I came with the story that I will have to have visas.
Yeah.
And the big Glassberg, you know, don't worry. My best friend is now the Minister of Interior in France.
Uh-huh.
How many visas you want? And I was stupid enough. I said, all right, London 20. Because, you know, I thought probably I'm going to get 20 people. But I thought I want to be large.
Right.
And he said, all right, give me the names. I can give you that. I don't know.
You don't know who they are. Yeah.
He said, okay, without the names, I can't get you the visas.
Right.
So I sat down and I prepared names of 250 people, families, father, mother, daughter,
you
sister.
You made it up.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the people had to fit themselves to. And I gave him the 250 names which I prepared in one night.
Uh-huh.
And he had flown to Paris. And a few days later, I get a telephone call from the French embassy in Tehran, French consulate, as a matter of fact. Monsieur Perez, we have here for you a list of a lot of names of visas to put at your disposal. I illegally there, getting telephone call from the French embassy in Tehran, that you have to come and collect the visas for these 250 people.
Right. And you didn't need photographs. You didn't need photographs of people. You just needed the names.
I just needed the names, and then we started to get the people. We have to fit them to the families, to the family, and to disguise them. But we worked with the Iranian police, so they didn't care much as far as they got their money.
Right.
So there was not real problem. But already I had 250 visas. And then the problem was to get the people out of Iraq to come,
right.
And I had a problem to be in touch with my people in Iraq,
right?
Because from
Iraq,
we had the wires from Iraq to Israel, to Palestine, then already to Israel it was already. But in Tehran I had nothing. And in order to be in touch with my people in Iraq, I had to go to the post office to send an open telegram to Paris to say in all kinds of things that to make them understand.
Right.
To hope that they will understand, to tell my people in Baghdad to send me 3 parcels, etc.
Right.
They didn't understand exactly what it was meant, so they sent it by cable to Israel already.
Right.
And our people in Tel Aviv, they shifted it and sent it to Baghdad. No one understood what's going on.
Wow.
So the problem was how to tell my people in Baghdad to start to send me people, because I want to send them.
Right.
So the funny story was that it has taken me weeks, and I couldn't get them to understand what's going on. in between, I found a group. I don't recall whether it was 7 or 9 communist Jews who ran away from Iraq by their own, because they were communists and they were Jews and they were persecuted, and they were hiding themselves in Tehran, but really hiding. Afraid to get out to be seen by the police, because the Iranian police hated the communists even more than the Iraqis.
Right.
So I went to them and I started to be in touch, and I said, well, you are a communist and you run away from Iraq, why don't you go to Moscow? He said, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? You're crazy in Moscow. So why don't you go back to Baghdad? In Baghdad they will hang us.
Right.
So I gradually convinced, look here, why don't you go to Israel?
Yeah.
Will they take us? I said, yes. But then the problem was, how are they going to take us? I had to convince them to be ready to go to the police, like we had the arrangement, to say we ran away from Iraq, and to be taken to the court to pay the fine. They were scared.
Mm-hmm.
But I convinced them, and the first group of people which they got the visas, actually, I got them and I sent them from Tehran to Paris. From Paris, they sent them to Marseille.
Right.
From Marseille, they waited to the ship to take them to Palestine, like Marco Polo, you know.
Around the world.
Around the world.
Amazing.
But gradually, our people in Iraq got the message. I found some smuggler who took a note from me to one man which I know, and he understood what I sent him, and then they sent me 2 people, and then they sent me 10, and this is 15.
A lot,
and I didn't know what to do with them. At first I put them in a hotel, but then I had to enter to the old cemetery in Tehran, and that's the story.
And you created a little camp there, a big camp.
In less than a year and a half, we had something like 12 to 13,000 people there.
Wow.
And this is what brought the Iraqi government. To my mind, the most important thing was what I did is to open this way to run away from Iraq to Iran, because by the end of 1949, there have been months that about 2,000 people run away from Iraq. People were arrested and were sent to prison, but they could not stop the running away. The Jews were running away for their lives. Families with children from the north, from the south, from the river.
And that bothered the Iraqi government.
It bothered, but they could not stop them.
Right.
I mean, they manage to arrest people, but not to stop the movement.
Now, it bothered the Iraqi government because it embarrassed them. Because the government
can always 2,000 people just disappear.
Right.
And it was already known that there are not, and it was already known, and already even the New York Times had already people who were sent to the border of Iraq and Iran to register how many people ran away. It was
overwhelming,
and the Iraqi government. They arrested people and they put them to prison and they harmed them, etc. But they could not stop it. And then they came to the conclusion. It was really again by chance. At that time, it was the Prime Minister of Iraq was elected. The man who was in charge of their delegation to the United Nations in 1949. Uh-huh. And in 1949, we raised hell against the Iraqis.
Yeah, in the UN.
In the UN. Uh-huh. It was after the Second World War, uh-huh. when still the United Nations was different from its composition today.
Right.
And people were still aware of what happened in Europe.
Right.
And when we were speaking about the persecution of the Jews in Iraq and the government arresting Jews there was an outcry in Iraq and the International Bank was supposed to give a loan to the Iraqi government, so he decided they are not going to give the loan anymore. Really, so the one who was in charge of the Iraqi delegation to the United Nations became to be all of a sudden. There was some change.
Switch in the government. Yeah.
He was elected to be the Prime Minister.
Who was this?
Tawfiq Suwaidi. Now, Tawfiq Suwaidi had a very good friend, a Jew by the name of Yechezkel Shem Tov.
Okay.
A remote second cousin of mine.
Uh-huh.
That he was elected to be the head of the Jewish community because he had to replace the head of the Jewish community that had to resign because he did not treat well the people. Thought those who were arrested and women and mothers went to his office and insulted him.
Who
so
was
he,
that?
It was Chacham Sasson Kaduri.
Okay.
He was for many, many years nominated by the government, by the way.
Right.
So he had to resign. And Yechezkel Shem Tov, he was a good man. He was a good Jew, I would say. He was not Zionist at all. He knew nothing about our activity.
Right.
Nothing whatsoever.
Wow. And why did Sasson Kaduri have to resign? I don't quite understand.
Because there have been demonstrations of the Jewish community against him, that he was not dealing with the government in order to free the people who have been arrested by the government.
I see.
And not doing enough in order to protect the Jewish community.
I see.
So it was,
okay.
In any case.
So Shem Tov,
he was a second cousin of mine.
Uh-huh.
He knew nothing about Zionist activity. He was he was more involved in the Iraqi community than. So Tawfiq Suwaidi called him. Look here, my friend Yechezkel. What should I do?
Yeah.
If I close my eyes, now it's 2,000. Next month it's going to be 3,000. It's out for all over. If we continue to arrest them, we have an outdoor in the United Nations and all over. What do you suggest to me?
Right.
So I thought, look here. And he really believed in that. Probably the whole story is about hot-headed youngsters who finished their school and now you don't let them work in the government. They are unemployed and they are... Let them go. There'll be 5,000,
yeah.
6,000. You get rid of them and we get rid of them.
Yeah.
And
he really thought that.
He really thought
it would be 10,000.
It did not occur to him that there is a real activity that we were dealing with.
Wow.
So passing a resolution that whoever wants to leave, please let him go.
Yeah.
Why do you want to keep him here against their will? And you will get rid of those who do not want to remain, and you will get rid from the people who are doing problems in the country and to our community.
Right.
And so really without our doing anything.
Wow.
The government brought a resolution because of what has been happening by the running away from Iraq to Iran.
Right.
To say that every, that, and the Minister of Interior who brought the resolution to the parliament said openly, because there have been recently people running away of Iraq without any regulations, without any surveillance, etc., and it's bad for the, and it's damaging the image of Iraq and the security of Iraq. We decided that every Jew who wants to leave Iraq for good has to give back his nationality, and he is free to leave Iraq. Not, God forbid, to Palestine. This,
or right, Israel, they didn't say that.
No, he didn't. But this was out of the question.
Right.
And he thought that there are going to be 7,000, 8,000 hot-headed youngsters there. And they did not realize that this brought to that 104,000 people gave back their nationality. And nowadays it's not true, but at that time I still have the New York Times wrote, it's then we started to bring our planes, etc. It was also a story how we brought it to the Iraqis.
Right.
And we have flown them from Iraq, from Baghdad, at first to Cyprus, because it was out of the question to land in. But
right.
Then in 1951 already, they would go directly from Baghdad to the Lida airport,
uh-huh.
And the Iraqi airport in every morning would be in touch with the Lida airport. It was not yet the Ben Gurion airport,
right.
At the time, to say today we have 3 planes, 700 people, and to be in touch with the
yeah.
airport.
How were you able to get it? The plane switched to Palestine from Cyprus. Why did
at that time we promised that the plane will not touch ground in Israel,
yeah.
But it will go to Nicosia. They used to send a police officer in the plane to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
When we landed in Cyprus, our people have taken care of this police officer to till the time to give him some better life than to stay in the airport.
Yeah.
And we have taken the plane directly to Lida, and the plane came back to Cyprus. It has taken this police officer, he returned back and said everything is okay. And
but then at some point the plane started going directly to Palestine from
in 1951 because
that
it was.
How did that happen? Why were you able to go?
Because
directly?
Already there had been tens of thousands of people who registered. They gave back their nationality,
yeah.
And the whole story of going through that it was impossible to finish. And they wanted to get rid of those who gave back their nationality. It was
right.
A situation. So they wanted to ease it, to make it to make
they,
it easier.
They made it easier by
yeah.
allowing it to
yeah.
go to Palestine.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow.
So, and I'm telling you that what the whole story, what happened, that I was stuck in Paris and I met Abbé Glasberg,
mm-hmm.
And he has taken me to lunch and gave me too much wine, and I told him the whole story, and then we went to Tehran and we started. This is what brought to the mass immigration, and I'm telling you that the New York Times wrote in those times its biggest air migration in history.
That's right.
Nowadays it's not true anymore.
But then it was.
But then it was the biggest air migration in history that was written by the New York Times.
Wow.
Yeah. But all this came by chance. If I could have gone directly to Baghdad, this could not have happened. If I would not have met the Abbé Glasberg, and he would not have taken me to the restaurant, this would not happen.
Right.
So I'm not claiming, look here, I have contemplated all. And I was there.
One step after
yeah,
the next.
Yeah.
Wow. So then in 1951, the doors were shut. The government said that's
it. Was for 1 year.
It was
for one year.
Year.
And then after that, they confiscated the property, which they didn't do at first,
right.
Of all those who registered. It was
a nasty
trick that was done. Well,
mm-hmm.
all these are details.
Mm-hmm. So when did you stop working you were in Tehran this whole time, while the Ezra and Nehemiah flights were going back and forth?
No. I left Tehran by the end of 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to Israel, and I was active in all kinds of things again concerning the Mossad, La Liabet and all that. And in 1950, after when the Iraqi government passed this resolution, this law, as a matter of fact, the law in the parliament, I went again to Iraq. This time as Richard Armstrong,
right,
from the Near East Company, to deal with the Iraqi authorities to give us the concession to take the Jews who said that they were ready to leave Iraq.
Right.
We also to take it to our company, because our company was, as a matter of fact, company working for AI by a Gentile American by the name of Jimmy Wooten. He passed away. I had some.
Oh, okay.
I still have some letters. I had some letters from him. And
so the agreement was between the Near East Transport Company.
That's right.
And the Iraq tours.
That's right.
So what was the relationship there, and how did you orchestrate that?
Well, there was Ronnie Barnett, a British boy, British subject, but a real British, not like
me.
Right. And he was working with us, and he was a real Jew, but a real British, a real British boy, and he was working with an air company that at a certain time worked with us, and then it worked with people taking Iraqi people to Mecca, to the pilgrimage, and there he met the director or the head of Iraqi Ken Techer, of the Iraqi Air,
Iraqi tours, okay.
By the name of Abdurrahman Rahim.
I'll look it up.
And he knew him. I mean, and he worked together. When this came about, he contacted him, and we went together. I went with Ronnie to meet him in Rome, and we told him that you can get a lot of money. And he said, I have something which I can tell you, that the Prime Minister of Iraq, Tawfiq Suwaidi, has shares in my company.
In the Iraq tours.
Uh-huh. So we went to Baghdad, and he arranged for us that we are going to meet the Prime Minister and to convince him to give the concession to our company.
Okay.
Which it was.
Right.
Again.
It could have been any number of companies, but it just worked out that way.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there was a competition of a British company that we were very scared that with the British, they will collaborate more with the Iraqi government than with us. Yeah.
So you went to safer
route. So again, I went to Baghdad in 1950, and that was the end of my activity in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, I was in 1951. I was in Egypt,
uh-huh,
and I came back from Egypt. But all this is
okay. One story I want to ask you to tell is Levi Eshkol, who was the head of the Jewish Agency at the time, before Ezra.
He was the treasurer. Yeah.
Treasurer. Said, how are we going to be able to handle all these immigrants? We don't have a place for them.
Yeah.
We can't do it. And we don't have housing, employment, all that stuff. And then you went to Ben Gurion himself.
I was taken to Ben Gurion. I said, I'm going to resign because I'm not stupid enough to go to risk my life and to tell the people, look here, but don't come.
Right.
And Ben-Gurion said, look here, Eshkol is absolutely right. We have no houses, we have no work,
uh-huh,
we have no food, we are going to have a problem. But you go and build them as fast as you can,
mm-hmm,
because who knows when the Iraqis are going to change their mind.
Wow.
This was
the
right.
Did you visit the Mavarot? You must have visited the Mavarot.
Oh, yes. When later on I became to be a member of the parliament.
Right.
This was my main activity, and I was
criticized. You were trying to get the people from the Mavarot out into real housing.
But I was criticized by the people from the Mavarot, because at that time there had been about 5,000 people, Jews, who remained there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very well off. I mean, they have taken all the jobs that were left, and they were very well to do. And they said, and at first I was really criticized by the people from the Mavarot.
Mm-hmm.
Why on earth you brought us to this misery? Look, But then gradually they
That must have been hard to digest for you, because you worked so hard for so many years and devoted.
Well, I understood.
We want to go back to Iraq. Do people ever say that? People say
no, they wanted to go back. No one really wanted to go back.
But they just complained about the circumstances in Israel. Sure. How many years did it take for the Ma'abara to close and for people to get into the
5-6 years.
Yeah.
A lot of time.
And did you devote most of your time as a member of Knesset to dealing with the Iraqi immigration, Mizrahi immigration?
No, not really. I was active in
many
in
different things, yeah, right? Yeah. But that was one part of what you did.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, one more question, and I'll let you go. Okay. The meeting with. You had a meeting at the, I don't remember what year it was, but with Fahima Shem Tov.
Yes.
And that was an emotional meeting. Can you describe that meeting? It was in Paris, I think.
No, it was in Israel.
Oh, it was in Israel, okay.
I met her father in Paris a few times, etc.
With Yechezkel Shem Tov?
Yeah, yes. But at that time I was already Minister of Police when she came. Because she was one of those who remained, the 5,000 who remained there.
Right.
And there was, in 1969, I think in January 1969, the Iraqi government hanged 9 Jews in one single day. It was really
terrible.
And they decided festivities, and they brought the children from the school. And she was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then she managed to run away through Iran, and then she came to see me. So and it was very, very moving, because I mean, she was one of those who remained in Iraq.
Right.
She, as I told you, neither she nor her father were Zionist.
Right.
Then she told me what has happened to them.
What has happened to the Jewish community?
The Jewish community during this, after the Six-Day War.
Because,
I mean, things were really horrible. People were arrested.
Right.
All the men were arrested, and then the trial and the court and the hanging in Baghdad. And then she said that from time to time she would hear my voice on the BBC. At that time I was the Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I was interviewed about what was going on in Iraq. And so it was really very moving.
Wow.
And then I met her once when I was in Canada, many years ago,
Well, you did a very good thing. A very important thing.
But I'm telling you, I'm not boasting. Look here, I knew.
I know you're not boasting in your book. You're very modest.
It's happened. I don't know. It was not my life.
You orchestrated a very big thing.
Yeah, but I was lucky.
Yeah.
I was lucky to be in the right place at the right moment. That's the only thing which I can say.
Okay, you're a modest man.
Yeah.